Today at Reader's Corner, baseball legend Jim Abbott, author of Imperfect, An Improbable Life. I'm Bob Custra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Jim Abbott is remembered in the annals of sports history as the pitcher who threw one of the most dramatic no-hitters in Major League history. He also is remembered for the challenges he faced to excel at the game. In his memoir, Imperfect, An Improbable Life, the one-time big league ace, who was born without a right hand, retraces his remarkable journey. From an early age, Jim Abbott dreamed of being a great athlete, despite his disability. He was an All-America hurler at Michigan, won the Sullivan Award in 1987, was the pitcher for the gold medal Olympic team in 1988, and threw a 4-0 no-hitter for the New York Yankees versus Cleveland in September 1993. Altogether, Jim played for 10 seasons on 4 different teams and ended his big league playing career in 1999. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Jim Abbott. Since retiring, he has worked with the Department of Labor's Office of Disability Employment Policy in the state of California, as a guest pitching instructor for the Los Angeles Angels, and as a motivational speaker. He joined us by phone for this interview. Jim Abbott, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you very much, Bob. It's great to be here.
A little bit of a shift for me, Jim, to do this interview, because most of the books that we do on this show are books that are written by somebody else about something else or about somebody else. We've had Roy Campanella's biography. We did one on Rin Tin Tin the other day. We've done shows on Pakistan and Afghanistan policy, the Berlin Airlift, Mark Twain, you name it. And then along comes a memoir, and it didn't occur to me until I finished it that this was a very different experience for the interviewer, and this show is not about the interviewer, but the fact is I feel like I know you better than I've known any of the folks I've had a chance to interview, because you really have in this book bared your soul. It's part baseball, it's part love story, it's part coming of age, it's part parenting, it's part overcoming disabilities. It's just an incredible amalgam of life's lessons. I guess I have to ask, for starters, when you and Tim Brown were working together on this book, are there any parts of it where Tim really had to coax you? Like, oh man, I don't want to go there. Can we leave that alone and let's not do that? Or were you ready to tell the whole story just like it shows up in the book?
Well, thank you. Definitely there were parts of the book that I knew somewhat in the back of my mind that we would have to delve into if it was going to be an interesting book and a book that people might be able to relate to. But I do have to give a lot of credit to Tim Brown. He was able to articulate some of the real difficult portions of the book, which really means some of the more difficult portions of my life, in ways that I didn't think that I would ever be able to do. You know, the first question a lot of people ask is, why did you write this book now? You've been out of baseball for over 10 years, and your story is one that happened a while back. And it's because of the fact that I don't think when you're playing baseball, you spend every day in that sheltered, very protective environment of a major league clubhouse, that you are able to open up in ways that I think are important to tell a story in a book and to be honest. And I certainly know I wouldn't have been able to do this while I was playing. And so I'm thankful to Tim Brown. He did help me to articulate some things. And I'm glad that the book is not just a sort of glossed over inspirational story.
You know, for any young boy or girl, for that matter, growing up, I think most of us remember those days when you all got this group of folks together and you divided up into two teams and there had to be somebody to pick who was going to be on which team. And we all have these memories of wanting to be picked high in the order and definitely not being picked last. And there was a moment of honesty in your book where you actually talk about the fact that you didn't get picked real high in the order back then.
And that can be a driving force in your life to be picked high in the order. And sure, I as a kid, I knew what it was like to be different. And I knew what it was like to be on the outside looking in and can't wait till class ends to get out on that athletic field of recess and to prove yourself. And then you're the last one picked. And you have this burning desire to show everybody, you know, hey, I can play football like you. I can play baseball like you. I can do it. And there's no question I don't think now, looking back on it, that my hand provided an ambition and a drive that probably wouldn't have been there had I been born differently.
I mentioned that this was part a parenting book. And in one sense, I could say that that's about you, because you come through as the writer, as somebody who was always weighing what effect your career had on your wife and your daughters. But I was really, when I mentioned parenting, thinking about your mom and dad. I wonder if you could share with us just what role they played. And I'd like you to tell the story of Mary Freebed Hospital and the decision to take you down there for a prosthetic device. And, of course, I'll let you tell it from there, but they had to leave you there, unfortunately, for a while.
Well, my parents were my heroes. You know, they, and I appreciate you mentioning it, because I do think they're a very, very important part of the story, if not the core of the story. They had me at a very early age. There was a great uncertainty in their life. And, you know, they had to make a decision to start a family. That's a very interesting process to look back on. It was for them and it was for me. And you pile on top of that here I was born missing my right hand. It only added to what had to be a very scary time in their lives. And yet they set out, you know, to raise a family. And being born differently and them being so young, there were just tremendous questions in their life of how do they go about this? You know, how do they help me to find my way in the world? And I don't think they knew. There was no manual for it. And, of course, they went down every path and they tried to figure out every which way they could help me. And they sent me to a rehab hospital. As a kid, I was very young. I barely remember it myself, but I remember having to stay there for a while and sleeping in this real stark, aqua-colored walls rehab hospital, and they had these beds with nets over the top of them, and all of this just to learn how to have a hooked prosthesis that I had as a kid. And I never really took to that hook, you know, if you'll pardon the phrase. I never really liked it very much. It helped me to pick things up and everything, but it didn't really help me do much anything else. But I love that prosthesis in a lot of ways, because it, to me, it's a symbol of my parents' efforts to try to help me and to try to provide the ways that, you know, I'm sure were expensive at the time, and they didn't have a lot of money, and also they were going to do anything to try to help me get through. And even the ways that didn't work out really represent the love and kindness that they showed me as a kid.
You're listening to Jim Abbott. He is the author of Imperfect, An Improbable Life. Well, you have a great quote in the middle of the book. I think it's something like, when you are told all your life that something meaningful is waiting, maybe you start to believe it. Certainly must have been your story.
My dad and my mom and dad, it really emphasized that. If they gave me one gift, it was the belief that exactly that, if something was waiting. I think what meant by that was that my missing a right hand was in some ways a gift. It was something to be lived up to, and that I was given so much more athletically and in other ways that would allow me to live up to this and to be responsible for it and to not be less of a person because I was missing a hand. And that was what was repeated to me over and over again. Every day I went out the door to school, my dad would say, "Be a leader, don't be a follower." And, you know, you shake people's hands, you shake people with your right hand, go up, meet people, you know, get involved, stay involved. And I don't know that I always appreciated those lessons as a kid, but now that I'm a parent, they certainly resonate.
Well, what certainly struck me about the book is just how lucky you were to have so much help, so many people who really cared. And the guy that really got to my heart was good old Mr. Clarkson. And the role, the key role he played, doesn't sound key to those of us who can tie their shoes with both hands, but tell us what happened there.
Well, I grew up in the great town of Flint, Michigan. And I tell that a lot and always get the chuckle from people. But it was a tough town. There was no question. There was a lot of economic strife and chances to get into trouble growing up in Flint. It was a tough town where you earned your way. You had to prove yourself. But it was a great town in the fact that there were people there who believed in me and who had an optimism and a spirit that I still can't believe. You know, Don Clarkson was my second grade teacher, and he had some physical limitations himself, so I think he took heart in my story, and one day he showed up during school and he pulled me in the hallway and sat two chairs across from each other and said, "I got it. I figured out a way for you to tie your shoes." And I hadn't learned how to tie my shoes to that point. My parents double knotted them six times over on my way to school, and I could never get those darn things untied. And there was Don Clarkson. You know, he put a film on for the rest of the class and pulled me in the hallway, and there we were learning how to tie my shoes. And that's the method I use to this day. It just strikes me so much, the generosity of that. And I think about him at night with his own shoes back home and working on those laces and loops. And it was just amazing to me. It sounds simple, but it was amazing to me.
Well, you had another adjustment to make, and that's figuring out how to handle a baseball glove, especially on the mound. Tell us about how you went through that in your younger years especially, but then later on in life, I think I remember these guys were actually watching you from the mound when you were in the majors, noticing that you were taking a little too much time to make the conversion or something.
I had to learn to throw and catch with my left hand. I couldn't play like the other kids, obviously, because I was missing my right hand and a glove wouldn't fit on it. It wouldn't stay on. So my dad bought me a right-hander's glove, and I put it on my left hand, and I just caught the ball, and I switched it off and grabbed the ball out of my glove and threw it and fired it back on. And it started pretty rough, I'll say that. I learned, slowly to get faster and faster at it. It took some time, and by the time I got to the major leagues, I was pretty quick getting that glove off. It turned into almost this spinning motion where I would twirl the glove towards my body and cradle it in my right arm and let the ball fall out into my left hand, and the glove would complete its rotation, finish up on my right nub, so to speak, and then I could throw the ball and have the glove ready to put back on. And obviously this lent, people thought maybe that would be a deficiency for me on the field. Maybe I wouldn't be able to field the position as well as others, but I worked hard on my fielding, and even on the AstroTurf, I felt like I held my own, and I don't really believe that my defense was a liability.
Do you remember a point in your career, your young career, before you made the majors, when all of a sudden it occurred to you, man, I'm just not some average kid out here on the baseball field, on the mound or wherever. I can actually go all the way into the majors.
It wasn't until my spring training of my, my rookie year when they told me, "You're coming to the major leagues," did I think that dream was attainable. I wanted the opportunity, and I certainly believed that I belonged on the field with those others who were getting the opportunity. I played at the University of Michigan, which was a very good baseball school at the time, so I had a chance to play at that level. And then I played on the United States teams. So I was playing with, Tino Martinez from the University of Tampa and Robin Ventura from Oklahoma State and Andy Benes from Evansville and Charles Nagy and these guys who I knew were going to be first-round draft picks and they were going to get the chance, and I was out there right with them. I was, we were competing together. So it was when I played for the USA teams that I felt like, hey, look at these guys. They're going to get the chance. I hope I get the chance too.
I want to talk about that cutting fastball. When did you first realize your fastball was doing something a little different than most of them? You probably ought to describe to our listeners just what I think everybody knows what a fastball is, but what is a cutting fastball, and when did you figure this out, and what role did it play in your career, most importantly?
What's funny about that, Bob, is I didn't really know it was called. It wasn't really called a cut fastball back then. It was just a ball that sort of cut in on right-handers. A cut fastball is a pitch that a left-hander or a right-hander throws that, instead of tailing away from a right-handed hitter if you're a left-handed pitcher, or tailing away from a left-handed hitter if you're a right-handed pitcher, and I was left-handed, the ball actually cuts in towards the hitter, which is particularly effective if it does it late in the pitch with wood bats, because batters aren't able to get the thick part of the barrel on the bat. So I knew that my ball moved a lot. It wasn't as predictable when I was in college. It kind of did a little bit of everything. But I found this grip. A college teammate of mine showed me this really funky, unorthodox grip, and all of a sudden this ball really started moving hard in right late in the batter's box or over the plate, and it was effective in college, but early in my major league career, it was very effective because those wood bats had trouble. I broke a lot of bats actually when I first got to the major leagues, and it was kind of exciting. I said, "Wow, what a fun tool to have!"
Right, right. Well, we have to get to this game, this no-hitter. Everybody who I've talked to in the last two or three weeks that we've had you scheduled for this show, I'd say, oh, yeah. Yesterday I was speaking to the Rotary Club here in Boise, and I said, yeah, I've got an interview tomorrow with Jim Abbott. And the minute I say the year 1993, all the heads start going up and down. Everybody remembers your no-hitter. And I know you've answered 1,000 questions, so forgive me. I'm going to ask the same ones, I guess. But the one thing that I got a kick out of was your reference to your catcher. What was your catcher's name?
Matt Noakes.
Noakes, yeah. I mean, he wasn't the guy that normally caught you that season, as I remember. Is that correct?
No, Mike Stanley was our normal catcher. Well, I shouldn't say normal. he caught the most often, and Matt Noakes was a guy who filled in for him. He was left-handed hitter, so if we faced a right-handed pitcher, then Matt would play.
And my recollection is that you gave the catcher quite a bit of credit. I mean, obviously, you're the guy out there throwing the pitches, but you give the catcher quite a bit of credit and provide the reader with some insights into what that relationship between the pitcher and catcher is. Share that with us.
You know, it's such an underrated relationship. I think fans can underestimate, and I think even people in baseball underestimate how important it is to have that trust and those positive feelings reciprocated between your pitcher and catcher. You know, he suggests the pitch. Ultimately, it's your decision what pitch you throw. But if you have dissonance, if you have, conflicting feelings about what is the right pitch to throw at a certain time, you can really create a lot of doubt in your own mind about what, he's calling curveball here. I'm trying to pitch a fastball. What's the right thing to do? And doubt is the killer of success in baseball. So Matt, that day, he was so enthusiastic. He really was one of those guys who would give you a little fist pump after a particularly good pitch. If you struck somebody out, he'd jump to his feet and fired the ball down to third base. And I really picked up on it that day of the no hitter. He was right there. He was so in the moment, and we had that trust going back and forth that he was suggesting the right pitches, and I was in total agreement.
And your wife Dana was there as well in the stands, and as I remember it, she ended up watching from a rather lonely perspective since everybody was so nervous she was sitting with.
Yeah, well, baseball has those dumb superstitions, and even the wives catch on to it that you aren't supposed to say anything to break up a no-hitter. You're not supposed to mention that something like that's going on. I don't know that that is a great idea. It kind of leaves you alone with your thoughts and left her alone with her thoughts and creates even more anxiety. But, it's a no-hitter essentially is a countdown. It's a countdown of outs that doesn't really start until the later innings, but all of a sudden in the back of your mind you're thinking 9 outs, 8 outs, 6 outs, wow, that's
sure.
Closer, 3 outs, and you feel it, whether it was the way she was feeling in the stands or the way the Yankee fans were feeling in the stands that day or the way I was feeling on the mound. It's as you get down to that final out, it's one more.
Yeah.
To get that final out and to see the celebration, it's just an enormous thrill.
And would I be correct in assuming that if that's going to happen up there in the stands with players' wives who don't want to bring it up, you're sure not going to have any of your teammates say a word about it? I mean, it's like the unspoken moment every time you walk off that mound at the end of the inning, I would assume.
Yeah, no, your teammates quit talking to you and the guys who it was actually a fairly lighthearted game. I don't know why. I was usually very serious when I pitched. But that day, for whatever reason, I felt a little bit more lighthearted. I was actually joking around with my teammates between innings and on the field, actually did a couple fun things, just to get them to laugh. And then all of a sudden, there's this seriousness that descends on the dugout and the guys who you've been sitting with, sharing a laugh with, are now, you know, 2 feet away from you or have gone up to the clubhouse entirely. So, like I said, it's not an effective method of helping somebody. You sit there and you're alone with your thoughts and you get wrapped up in the anxiousness. But, man, what a feeling. I mean, it's just so exciting. And I just cherish that day so much.
Well, you mentioned the, maybe joking or clowning around, whatever it is. That's putting it too strongly. But as I remember it, as you left the mound and headed for the dugout, you did some kind of a little step that I thought, oh, my God, he really did that right there in the middle of that no-hitter. What was that all about?
Well, I think it was just a retention release, really. I had a great friend on the team, a guy named Scott Kamenicki, who I went to the University of Michigan with. He was a senior when I was a freshman, and we'd known each other, and our paths crossed again with the Yankees. And Scott was having a good year that year, and another good friend of mine on the team, Jimmy Key, we would laugh at Scott. Whenever he got the third out of an inning, he sort of had this exuberant run off the field. He almost hopped off the field. And we used to laugh at him all the time the way he did it. And after a couple of the innings in that no-hitter, I would jump off the mound and sort of imitate that run to try to get Cammy to laugh and Jimmy Key. And they got it. They watched. And when a couple innings after I got back to the dugout, they were just cracking up. Those stupid things baseball players do to keep themselves amused.
Sure. Well, was that the best game you ever pitched?
Not really. I mean, it was a highlight and in a lot of ways career-defining. But I pitched better games. I had better stuff. I was wild that day of the no-hitter. I walked 5 guys, hence the title of the book, Imperfect. It wasn't a perfect game, but in a lot of ways it was my most memorable and my most cherished.
I'm talking today to Jim Abbott, the former major league pitcher, about his book, Imperfect, An Improbable Life. Well, I'd like to close with a few minutes here talking about all these kids over the course of your career who sought you out. Many times during the book, you talk about how often a parent would steer their kid toward you to talk to you, and you'd see there'd be a missing hand or there'd be some abnormality that just caused this kid to want to talk to somebody that had this happen to them. If you could just share with us what that meant to you as a player and then bring it up to the present. I know you're working for the Department of Labor, and what role you play now in working with and inspiring kids who were challenged like you were.
When I got to the major leagues, it had been all about me for a long time. You know, I was entirely focused on being the best pitcher I could be, and that remained my goal when I got to the major leagues. There's absolutely no question about that. But when I got there, I started to see the power of the game and people started connecting with the way I played, the fact that I was missing a hand in every town that we went to. It didn't matter the team that I was on. Parents started coming to games and kids, you know, facing very similar challenges to me and some facing challenges much, much worse. And they wanted to talk to me and they wanted to talk about my experiences and my parents' experiences and those were very poignant, memorable times, maybe the greatest of my career. I didn't always want to go, to be honest with you. There were those meetings in a lot of ways were reminders to me that I was different. And in some ways I would be sitting with my teammates and I'd get the inevitable tap on the shoulder and they'd pull me away from my teammates and remind me again that I wasn't quite like the rest of the team. And I'd walk down there and I'd meet a family and I'd meet a mom and dad or a little boy and he'd have his jersey on and a glove and, you know, maybe we'd start playing a little game of catch and all of a sudden, you know, there was these smiles that started happening and it was incredibly inspiring. And I would walk back up to the clubhouse and they would go on their way. And I never walked back into that clubhouse uninspired. You know, I never walked back, you know, bound and determined to make the most of the opportunity that I had been given, what I had been given in my left hand, and bound and determined to forget about, you know, not having a right hand. And in a lot of ways, that's the inspiration for me, and it was the inspiration to write this book, to share those stories and to hopefully inspire people to think along those same lines.
Well, in addition to all the wonderful things you've done for kids and for parents of kids in those situations, you yourself struggled especially toward the end of your career, trying to figure out what to do. You sought the help of a guy who you quoted at the very beginning of your book, Harvey Dorfman, a great example, I think, of recognizing the need to get some help, and you went ahead and got it. I think if I remember correctly, he was a sports psychologist of some kind. But I guess the question I have for you as an ex-major league ball player, and from your discussions in the book of what it's like making that transition, does Major League Baseball do enough to prepare players? Can they do any more to prepare players for, let's call it, the afterlife? And I'm just talking about life after being on the field.
You know, I think it would be helpful. I do think that there could be some education. It is very, very difficult. And hey, listen, I know there's not a lot of sympathy out there for professional athletes who are lucky enough to make it and then, you know, find themselves heading out into the real world after having all these great experiences and hopefully, you know, making some money and a chance to set themselves up. But there is a sense of loss. And you know, for me, it was particularly poignant because I really ended up, after a few years of professional disappointment, I didn't do well at the end of my career. I failed in a lot of ways. I only won 2 games 1 year. I lost 18 games and had one of the worst years in baseball that year, if not in over the past 25, 30 years. And so I felt the sting of that very much, that disappointment of not finishing the way you want to finish. And that part of me that had been such an important part of propping up my self-esteem was all of a sudden gone. And so that was an important part of the book, to take a look at, you know, how we handle that adversity, you know, how we turn and look to ourselves without the crutch of professional success. And it's very difficult. I would encourage anybody to seek friendship and to seek purpose. I think that's the most important thing after your career is over, is to find something. I don't care how much money you made. Find something that you can direct the skills that you used to direct at baseball towards something else you feel passionately about.
Well, you're doing a wonderful job of that, Jim, and I thank you so much for writing this book, and thanks for appearing here on the show. We've really enjoyed the interview.
Thank you very much. It's been an honor, and the response has really been heartwarming.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Jim Abbott. Next week, Soner Çaptay, author of The New Sultan, Erdogan and the Crisis of Modern Turkey. And under the category of what I am reading lately, I've been reading a smorgasbord of books, some of which are related to our recent travels in Europe. The Shetland Bus by David Howarth is the tale of the Norwegian-named spy ring during World War II, that organized trips by fishing boats from the Shetland Islands to Norway, thereby rescuing refugees from German-occupied Norway and supplying weapons and supplies back to Norway. These were dangerous journeys from 1,000 to 2,000 miles in length, and the Germans attacked those small fishing boats regularly, with the Shetland crews on them having no way of being saved. It was heroics of the highest order. I might add, this is a very old book that you'll have to get from the library if you're interested. Again, The Shetland Bus by David Howarth, H-O-W-A-R-T-H. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research for today's show by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Joe Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. If you missed some of our recent shows, including last week's interview with Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Zablot, authors of How Democracies Die, you can find them on our website. That's BoiseStatePublicRadio.org. You can also sign up for our free podcast email on the website and download our free app for mobile devices to listen anytime, anywhere.